I got a question after that. You got a chance.
Dick, how proprietary could it be if they're on display? Somebody could just go and look at them and know the depth. And by the way, did you ever think possibly interior? Paul had mentioned that maybe interior there's a space that they infiltrate between the walls. What about expanding foam? Maybe something like that. You know, a special type of foam they may have developed. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, inflation between the walls. If you're trying to make a structure that's going to be inflated and automatically form into a particular shape, you've got some advantage inflating between the walls. That's not their problem. And when it comes to the difference between expanding and inflating, in this expanding versus inflating, when you've got a structure on the ground, I accept that. When it's a structure in space, the word expanding has no meaning compared to inflating. When you're in the vacuum of space and you put 14.7 pounds per square inch of air inside, and something is 330 cubic meters, which means that if it was a cube, it literally would be 7 meters by 7 meters by 7 meters, a little bit shy of that. When you got something that big and you put 14.7 pounds per square inch, you don't have to expand that. That pressure of that air pushing against those walls by the Laplace equation is giving you a wall tension of many thousands of pounds. At any, you know, any square foot of that wall, it's got many thousands of pounds stretching it horizontally and vertically, so to speak. You couldn't stop it from inflating. If you tried to build a structure in there to stop it from inflating, boy, you wouldn't be able to do it. So when you're in space, expanding versus inflating has no meaning. In either case, you're going to put the exact same amount of air in there, and when you put that air in there at 14.7 pounds, boy, you're going to get a heap of pressure out of it. So, I don't...
What about radiation?
What about radiation? In other words, when you've got all those layers of Kevlar, according to what they said, you've got a lot more protection from the meteorite, and when it comes to radiation, the way you protect yourself from radiation is to put a lot of mass between you and the source of radiation. And whether it be steel or lead, it's the number of pounds of stuff that matters. If you put yourself behind a wall that's 5 inches thick and it's steel and it's 5 inches thick and it's lead, because the lead is, let me pick a number, 3 times heavier, you get 3 times as much shielding from the lead. So it's the amount of mass. So because this inflatable structure might be lighter in total number of pounds, that might give you a little bit less shielding. Do they give you any hints, Paul, as to these inflatable structures? Is it lighter in pounds compared to a metallic structure? If so, it's going to give a little bit less shielding. WS2N, K2IW in the TechNet.
Yeah, the weight was like 1/3, and the size is 25%, something like that. You know, John mentioned you can walk in and see, you just don't get into this place. And the pictures I saw was, you know, they had the NASA administrator a few years back, which was Lori Garver. She was in there and got a tour, took some pictures, and that's what made it out onto the, for the public's consumption. And it looked really good. She was in a mock-up of the 330, the big one that would be attached to her, maybe to one another, creating a space station. The size of one of these is about 3 times the size of Destiny, which is our big module on the International Space Station. So, now they have another deputy administrator, Dava Newman, and she'll be involved with, approving further modules that they plan on building these things. By the way, Newman is her whole life story of engineering before, getting involved with NASA as the deputy administrator was in these tight-fitting spacesuits that will be one on Mars, you know, so-called new design, similar to what you see on the show, the movie The Martian. So, I mean, this is a feasible idea that they really plan on doing. I had to mention that. That just came to my mind. The beam is...
Repeater, time out.
The beam is going to be good for 2 years, and then they're going to deorbit that. In the interview, they said it could stay up for 5 years, but eventually they're going to need that port. They're going to need that port where it's located for another purpose. But as far as radiation goes, they've tested these things for radiation. They've tested them for micrometeorite impacts, just the same way as you would test a metal can system, a metal sphere. And it's been all human approved by NASA. And what could I tell you? I mean, this guy, well, they're standing by it. Let's see what happens. I think it's going to work out. Back to you.
When it comes to the size pool, I'm a little bit confused. At one time, you said it's 3 times bigger than a Destiny module. And then you said its size is 25%. And you said 25%. Is it 25% of the volume? Is it 25% of the width? And 25% of the length? So, is it bigger? Is it smaller? And what did you mean by 25% of you, Paul? K2LIW?
Yeah, I'll have to go back to last week's net, which I have. But as far as the actual dimensions, I know the actual dimension for the sphere, if you want to call it a sphere, is 13 by 10. Now we know 13 feet with the diameter, and you know, 10 feet deep, or the other way around. But nevertheless, the difference. Yeah, I'm comparing apples with oranges. The VA330, that's the proposed big one that they'll use for space stations. That one is 3 times bigger than the Destiny module. Destiny module is about, 25 feet long, 26 feet long, something like that, about 14 feet in diameter. This thing's about 21 feet in diameter, and it's probably about as long, you know, a little shorter, I think around 20 feet. But volume-wise, it's got 3 times the volume that Destiny has. So that's what I was talking about. Now, the other one, the one that they're going to be doing on the 8th of April, when they bring it up, is called the Beam. That one's going to be about one-third the weight of a standard module of the same size, of a metal module. And let's call it about the same difference for, mass and size when it's compressed. When it's compressed, it's going to be 7 feet by, 7 feet by 5 feet, and then it's going to expand to 13 by 10. Back to you, Nick.
I was writing down those numbers. So 7 by 5 when it's compressed, 13 by 10 when it's expanded. So it's not folding up like a balloon. I mean, if you take the volume of a balloon that's fully inflated, and you take that balloon and you take all the air out of it, make it as small as you possibly can, that ratio might be 100 to 1. And so this thing is not collapsing anywhere near that amount. And with an 8-inch thick wall, I can sort of see that. Wow. So the major advantage, if I understand correctly, is you save a little bit of volume because you can uninflate it. And it's lighter. But being lighter, I am guessing you get a little bit less shielding. You may get more protection from a meteorite or a meteor because of the strength you get, the penetration resistance you get from Kevlar, for example. I believe a number of the bulletproof vests are made out of multiple layers of Kevlar with other stuff in between. So the Kevlar is where the real strength is coming from. So I can see how you get meteorite protection, but with the less mass, you might be getting less radiation protection. And so it's lighter. Do you believe it's cheaper, Paul? I mean, if even though it's lighter, if this is twice the number of kilobucks compared to a metal chamber, I wonder if you're getting your money's worth. Look, all of those layers of exotic materials, I'm a little bit worried they could be expensive. And one of the questions I asked last week, I know it's a hard one to answer, is what is the thickness of the metal module? What's the thickness of the wall of a metal module? And is that wall multi-layers? In other words, is there an inner wall and outer wall with some kind of protective material in between that is self-sealing if a meteor hits you? WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, I still don't know the exact number. It looks like around 4 inches anytime I look at it. 4 or 5 inches. And from what I understand, it's a double system. You know, you have metal on the outside, metal on the inside. And then you've got some kind of insulation, of course, in between, and which really holds the heat in. And they have a hard time getting rid of heat on the International Space Station. It just... That's the nature of things. You don't have convection involved. Everything is... When you get it outside, it's all infrared. You know, you got to radiate it. No air going by the radiators to cool it off. But yeah, I'm sure they're going to have the same problem with beam. After it's attached, they have these vents. You know, you're going to close the door. It'll only be opened up maybe 3 or 4 times a year. The astronauts are going to set up some kind of instruments inside for radiation detection and heat. The temperature is going to stay the same inside. There's no condensation or anything, so they're going to have constant airflow going in and out. The doors will be closed. I did hear that report. We'll see how it works. And I'm just wondering about, well, when you get to the larger size, you know, like this 330 thing, it's big. You know, they have ones I've seen, you know, they have six, you know, like dummies inside of the thing, a demonstration of how big it is. And, you know, I think of all the equipment and everything that has to go up, and how they're going to set it all up.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I knew that was going to happen. But when I think of all the equipment that has to go up, you know, right now you send up a metal can, you know, and with that module, there's racks in there, there's equipment, there's bags that's already set up, there's, you know, they got, you know, sleeping quarters. But now with this new design Bigelow's got, what are they going to have to do? Send another rocket up and then have crews bringing the stuff into the inside and then setting it all up? So you're going to have, you know, the same problem that we started with. You know, it's going to be a lot of mass that still has to get up there and now assembled inside this thing that you just expanded. It reminds me of, you know, the guy, he's sitting at home with the model, you know, with a big bottle, and he's got a model, and he wants to get this model inside the bottle. You know, what you got to go through to do that. Back to you, Derek.
When it comes to the heat that must be dissipated by the International Space Station, I just did a couple of quick calculations that tells me immediately how difficult that is. You told me in the past that when the solar cells are running full blast on a bright, sunny day, so to speak, they produce 128 kilowatts of electrical energy. Essentially, all of that electrical energy goes inside of the International Space Station, and it's running motors and compressors and spectrum analyzers and transmitting equipment and cameras. It's running all kinds of stuff. But all of those things in there are not doing any work as far as the outside universe is concerned. So all of that electrical energy you're pumping into there, essentially all of it eventually becomes heat inside of the International Space Station, and maybe a little bit becomes light that runs out the window, but that's not very much. And now let me show you an interesting experiment that I've done. Let me drop.
I think it's going to be about half that energy, Dick.
Even half. You're about to find out how bad it is. because I buy my oil from my oil burner on the spot market, I call it the spot market. In reality, I keep going to the exact same guy because his price is not that that different from the best price. Joe does a little bit more shopping than I do, and he really finds out each month who's got the lowest price. But I keep going back to the same guy. My last delivery of oil was $1.44 a gallon, $1.44.9. On one occasion per decade, I cut it too close and I run out of oil. Okay? That's not a disaster. I usually have a couple of those yellow containers of oil because once before I've run out of oil and I go over to the nearest filling station and I take diesel fuel, which is the exact same stuff. I put it in that container, take it home, and put it into my oil tank. So that can happen at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I can create heat at 2 o'clock in the morning. But on a couple of occasions, let me drop. I decided that what I would do instead is I turned on the four burners of my electric range. And those four burners all together make something in the vicinity of 15 kilowatts of heat. All four burners running full blast. 15 kilowatts of heat turns into 51,000 BTU per hour, which my furnace, when it's running full blast, can make 120 BTUs per hour, I think is the number. But I never run it full blast, never run it to, 100% duty factor. It goes on for 10 minutes and off for the next 20 on a winter day. So if I can turn out 51,000 BTU with the four burners of my electric range, I can keep my house warm. I'll admit that the kitchen is going to be a lot warmer than the living room, but at least the house doesn't go into freezing. I get uneven heating, but then again, I can even that out. I can turn on the blower. I've got a hot air heating system, so I can turn on the blower, and that automatically distributes the air everywhere. So 51,000 BTUs, except for a super cold day, can keep my house warm. That's 15 kilowatts of heat. And they can generate half of 128, let me drop. That's what, 64 kilowatts. They can generate with their electric solar cells 64 kilowatts, and I can only generate 15 kilowatts. Wow. That's a lot of BTUs. You and I could calculate it. And the probability number is something like 200,000 or 300,000 BTUs of heat that they've got to dump. And so I can see how that ammonia heat exchanger system is really working full blast. And my guess is if they ever develop a failure of a portion of that system, and I hope there's some redundancy in there, I hope they got multiple pumps and multiple circulators, if you know what I mean, going to multiple radiators. But when one or two of those fails, my guess is a number of the pieces of electrical equipment inside, they have no choice but to turn it off. Otherwise, the place is going to run hot. I wonder if anything along those lines has ever happened with your experience with keeping track of the International Space Station. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Over the years, they've had, two pump failures. I call it pump failures. One was, bad valve, but they're all, it's one big unit, so it all has to be changed out. And that brings down, 25% of the system. So, and they consider that a priority. They don't let that go. So they all, they train for all these EBAs. Some of the EBAs they're training for, it's specific. For instance, later on this year they'll launch another SpaceX mission with IDA on board, the International Docking Adapter, and they'll train to, they already have trained to install that. That's going to go to the end of PMA 2, Pressure Mating Adapter 2, and eventually Pressure Mating Adapter 3 on a future mission. But, some of the other training that they do, they'll practice to change out these ammonia pumps. They'll practice changing out these power, I'm going to call them, drops. Power regulating system. They're like big, huge suitcases. And they have to be able to do all this not too recently. Scott Kelly was out there doing that. And because, you know, when that system was down, 25% of the solar panels won't work. And that's what I mean by a lot of the heat never gets into the space station. You know, it generates on the 28,000 kilowatts. But they changed that to 120 bulb AC outside. They do that, and then, you know, to do all that, that's generating heat, and then they're storing it in these big 40 amp hour batteries. They got a million of those things up there. I don't know how many, but a lot. And all this heat is being generated before it even gets into the space station. So then that in turn goes to these ammonia systems, and then, you know, that's pumped to the radiators. Now, whatever electricity that they do use, of course, winds up inside the space station. I'm not going to say it's, you know, half the amount, but maybe less than half the amount that's really getting into the space station. And whatever experiments they're doing and creating, you know, it's all generating heat. I think bodies, people's bodies generate around 200 or 300 watts sometimes. So, you know, all that has to, you know, be put outside the space station. You have six people up there living. Eventually, you're going to have seven. In another year or two, you're going to have a permanent crew of seven, not six, back to you.
Yeah, a human being sitting in a chair listening to music in an audience is generating 450 BTUs per hour. That turns out to be roughly 130 watts. So you are a 130-watt generator when you're sitting in a theater seat just listening to music. And if it happens to be real good rock music and you're jumping up and down and shouting, I bet you can easily go to 200-300 watts of heat that your human being can generate. A man doing work, hard work, like moving himself around in a space suit, because the space suit is really so stiff, you have to do a lot of work to bend the elbows and bend the knees and so on of that space suit. So you're doing work just to do a simple walking-like procedure, so to speak. Let me drop. The thermodynamics of what we're talking about here is kind of exciting, but I just thought of something else. Remember I said that energy cannot be created or destroyed, and so therefore by the conservation of energy, if you use that concept and figure out how much heat is coming off your antenna tuner, you can easily rate its efficiency. It's a much easier way than to electronically measure something when you've got drastically different input impedance and output impedance and highly reactive output impedance, to really measure with high accuracy how much energy is flowing. We're talking about true watt hours. We're not talking about an apparent volt amperes. There's a huge, you know, there's a power factor involved. You get a huge power factor when you've got a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna. So evaluating power accurately is kind of difficult. But when it comes to energy, another thing, energy cannot be created or destroyed. Mass cannot be created or destroyed. So if to maintain a human being for 1 year takes an amount of air, food, and water, which has the volume of your house and the mass of your house, that human being takes all of that stuff and turns it into waste products. Out of that human being comes carbon dioxide. The number of cubic meters of air you put into a human being and the number of cubic meters of air that comes back out of the human being is very close to the same number of cubic meters. The number of gallons of water you put into that human, the number of gallons of water that comes back out, is almost the same. The number of pounds of food and the number of pounds of waste is almost the same. So the bottom line of all this, let me drop, is that that human being is consuming one house full of volume of food, air, and water. He is making waste products that have the exact same volume and the exact same mass. The human being is, for the most part, he's not gaining weight, he's not losing weight, he's not changing volume. So therefore, the exact same amount of waste products is coming back out. So each human being is generating a house full in volume and the mass of a house of waste products. Each human being per year is doing that. This is not a pleasant subject, but how in the world are they getting rid of that much volume and that much mass of waste products on the International Space Station? You got 6 astronauts on there. They're generating 6 households full of waste products per year. Explain that one to me, Paul. WS2N, this is a tough one, I know. K2RAW in the TechNet.
It's all the packaging.
Yeah, it's got to be packaged in a way that's safe, and that isn't easy. Explain this to us, Paul. This is a tough problem. Where the hell does all that mass and all that volume go of waste products? You got it, Paul.
All these spacecraft that are going up there, not Dragon, but Cygnus, brings up 8,000 pounds of worth of stuff. Progress brings up a little less, about 6,000 or 7,000 pounds worth of stuff. The H2, that's the one by HCB2, they call it, the 10,000 pounds by Japan, and that usually goes up roughly once a year. So now you lower all this stuff up, they stay attached to the space station. For instance, now Cygnus is up there now. That won't be detached for another couple of months, and when it does, it will have probably 2,000 to 3,000 pounds worth of trash and waste and things that are going to get burnt up. Deorbits the space station. Within a day, in most cases, within a day, it'll burn up over the Pacific Ocean. Cygnus is a little different. They're going to do some fire experiments on board before it deorbits. But make a long story short, everything except for the ones that come back with people, which is Progress. And the Dragon by SpaceX, that comes back and lands in the Pacific Ocean. That brings back science, you know, experiments, thousands of pounds worth of stuff like that. So that's where we're getting rid of all the mass, the heat. Well, that goes out to radiate, it's back to there.
But it takes a lot of square meters of radiator. I'm beginning to think, when I've seen some of the pictures of the International Space Station, I see these huge solar arrays, and I think I see other things near the solar arrays at right angles to the solar arrays. Could that possibly be the heat radiators, Paul, that I'm looking at? Over to you, K2RAW.
Yeah, and you can tell they're angled, you know, they're staggered as they go out. And that big, I mean, you know, I think each one has got to be 40 feet long or so. And there's a whole bunch of them on the right-hand side, well, the port side and the starboard side. You see them attached. They're dark-looking. And I would say they're about half the length, a little less than half the length of the solar panels. Solar panels, well, at the end, they're like 250 feet. So these things end-to-end probably are 100 feet, I guess.
Question, Dick.
Yeah, John recognized it. My first question to Paul is that is the total area of those radiators, very rough guess, is that roughly one-third the area of the solar panels themselves? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I would guess so. I would say probably a little bit less than that. But, yeah, that would be a good guess. Now, remember, Russians have radiators on their side and solar panels as well, but nowhere near the amount of solar panels that we have. John?
Just a quick question. What do you think about these inflatables? If we were to fill the inner wall, if there's such a thing, what about water? If they fill that with water or glycol, either one would freeze, probably give them some better radiation protection. Maybe that's what they're doing that they're not telling us. Back to you.
Now, they're not going to be doing that yet, but I mean, they plan on eventually having another layer, no matter what they use, either tin can versions or inflatables, or like they call them, expandables. And they think they're eventually going to store water, you know, throughout the walls. You know, they use bags, really, bag after bag of water, and they'll have to store it somewhere. So they got plans on eventually going to Mars. The whole spacecraft isn't going to be designed with like that, but, you know, you're going to have, like, I'll call it a panic room, you know. There's a, you know, one of these coronal mass expulsions coming off the sun. You've now got, you know, 48 hours or so, whatever it is, to, I think they go a million miles per hour. You've got that much time to get into your panic room. And that'll be the room that's completely surrounded with water, preferably on the side of the sun. Back to you, John.
Okay. Well, it's just something I was thinking of, and it sounds like it would work. So that is scheduled something in the future. Very good. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGP.
Yeah, if you've ever gone to a nuclear power station, quite often you'll see where they store the used rods. They put them in the bottom of a great big pool of water, and you look down into that pool of water and you see this blue glow of all the radiation coming off, hitting the water, and the water is a massive substance and does a good job of absorbing those, I guess, the primarily neutrons that are flying out of there. So water is a very good massive material, not quite as good as lead, but a lot easier to live with.
Dick, what about when it turns to ice? Is there a big difference?
I think the answer is no. When it comes to protecting yourself from neutrons flying out of a radioactive source, how much protection you get is how many pounds of stuff is between you and the source. So if I take liquid water and freeze it, I got the exact same number of pounds, I got the exact same number of molecules. Just those molecules are not moving around as freely. They're now locked together into a matrix. But I think the amount of shielding you get is almost the same. There's a huge difference, water in liquid form versus water in solid form, when it comes to absorbing radio waves as a dummy load. Huge difference. We're talking about two orders of magnitude. I think you go from, water can absorb 98% of your energy when it's in a liquid form and only a couple of percent of your energy when it's in an ice form. That's why an ice cube in a microwave oven doesn't do anything. Let me drop it. It sits there, it remains ice cold. It's almost completely inert. By the same token, when you get the snow caked onto your microwave dish, very little detriment in performance takes place. A lot of people don't know that. They waste their money buying heaters to get rid of all the snow off the dish. I don't think they have to do that. The snow is reasonably transparent. It's a slightly dielectric material, but it gives you a little bit of difference in tuning, but not much. But when it comes to the mass that does the shielding, I am guessing ice does almost the same. I wonder if you've read anything along these lines, Paul. And by the way, you want to make sure that the water in the walls doesn't freeze. You're going to put glycol or whatever in there, because when the water freezes and expands, I think it can do some damage to the wall. But putting glycol in the water is a little bit uncomfortable, because now you don't have the option of using that water as a consumable, either to convert it into oxygen or to use it for drinking purposes. So you got a conflict of interest there as to whether or not you do put glycol into that water. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I don't think that would be a problem in the expandable one, Dick. In the fixed metal, yes.
I wouldn't want to put frozen water in between those walls and let it freeze and then expand. I think it could damage the walls. That's my guess. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, you would just have a regular space station, and you would strap these things with Velcro straps, these bags of water, just like they do now, and they attach them, you know, in various places. And, you know, you could picture a whole wall lined up with these there. They're going to be for consumables. And they have, you know, they do have tanks of water, you know. Bags, especially, wind up in tanks of water. There's gray tanks, and, you know, different color tanks for different types of water uses. So it's a big thing. There's no fuel cells on board the space station. And from what I understand, there's not going to be any fuel cells on Orion either. That's going to be all powered by solar panels. But that should be interesting. You used to get a lot of water from the fuel cells, but no more. So things are changing. So I guess when they go to Mars, they're going to rely on solar panels. I can't imagine that they're not going to have any fuel cells, but I haven't read anything yet. In fact, anything I've read, it's all solar panel. When we went to the moon. Let me drop it.
Yeah, when you went to the moon, all the electrical energy came from fuel cells because you had lots of tanks of oxygen on board. And the fuel cell, I think it primarily consumes oxygen and makes electrical energy and gives you water in return. I guess it's running on, it must be running on both oxygen and hydrogen. And that's a very compact source of energy to run a space station. To put great big solar panels on something like the Apollo spacecraft would be a bit of a pain. Let me drop.
Mercury was battery powered.
Which is even worse. You get a lot more energy density out of packing oxygen and hydrogen and pouring it into a fuel cell. You get a lot more dense energy out of that compared to a battery. However, you're continuously using a consumable, oxygen and hydrogen, when you run that fuel cell. Whereas when you're using solar panels, you're not consuming a consumable. You're just taking solar energy and converting it directly to electrical power. So as long as you've got the ability to set out all those zillion square meters of area of solar cells, you're way ahead of the game to run solar cells as opposed to fuel cells. Because fuel cells, you have to continuously, you're breaking up all kinds of oxygen and water and whatever now to keep the humans alive. If you had to bring up even more oxygen and water and hydrogen in order to keep the fuel cells running, that's much more of a cargo requirement. So all of that cargo requirement for the fuel cells goes away when you're willing to use photovoltaics. So it's making a little more sense there now, Paul. Over to you. And when it comes to the energy required for something like Voyager, solar panels are not going to work that far away. Consumables in a fuel cell is not going to do it. Therefore, you run nuclear. My guess has been, let me drop it. There's probably been a couple of very quick proposals to consider using nuclear power on the International Space Station. And I'll bet you for a whole bunch of reasons that got rejected immediately. Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, look at the size of that thing. The panels won, the sun won, and Orion's going to be like that. You have these very big diameter, probably about, looks like a little over 15-foot diameter solar panels that'll unfurl on Orion, and they look exactly like the ones right now. If you look at Cygnus, you have your regular rectangular solar panels that stuck out, and now on the enhanced version, this one that went up and the last one that went up in December, they're the first of the enhanced ones. They're about one-third longer spacecraft to hold one-third more space and cargo, but they also have these new solar panels, which are about 600 pounds lighter than the old ones, but the diameter, I think on those, are around 12 feet, and they open up in a circular fashion. So I think they get them from Germany, a German company. And they were first used, I remember, on the Phoenix lander, Mars lander, and they were going to be used on the one that they just canceled until 2018. composite, what was it called? I've got to be one on an IM. I'm a little tired here. I'll think of it back to you then.
What about the James Webb?
The rectangular solar panel system that they have. Naturally, of course, on the back side of it, because that'll be the solar facing side. And, why can't I think of the name of the Mars lander that they just canceled until 2018? I'll think of it.
That's even bigger than the current one that's running around. Curiosity, I think, is the name of the one that's running around right now. And so the new Mars lander is going to be even bigger and more scientific experiments looking for past life events. So you'll think of that name. Also, when it comes to the solar panels being used on the International Space Station or any of these other new craft, has anyone quoted what kind of solar conversion efficiency they're getting these days? WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, the Mars lander was InSight. That's the one with the titanium sphere that leaked. Being built in, you know, that sphere was, the instrument was being built in France. Canes, the group that was handling that, they managed to figure out what the problem is, but they lost their window, so they had to wait. You'll notice that every time there's rockets that go to Mars, it's roughly every 2 years. It's, every 26 or 27 months, we line up with Mars again. And the other Mars rover that we're sending is called Mars. Right now, it doesn't have a name yet. They call it the 2020 rover. And it's very similar to Curiosity, but it's going to have all kinds of light detecting gadgets on board, and it's going to have a place to, it's got a core boring machine instead of just a drill. It's going to core bore samples and leave them on board the rover, and eventually when we send a rocket, there'll be a sample return mission eventually before we send people, and that sample return mission will go with another rover, go over to the thing, meet up with it, bring it back to the launcher and send it back to Earth. These are all long-term plans, but I mean, that's what's on 2020, Dick, will be up.
And the way you talk, it sounds like 2020 is on schedule, going to be launched that particular day, which is, what, 4 years from now? It's not that long. 2 years after James Webb. Has NASA made any rough approximations of manned landing on Mars? Are they saying approximately 20 years, approximately 40 years? Have they given any very, very loose schedule of manned landing? And now that manned landing is two forms. The first form, if they follow through, is going to be one-way missions. People who go there and never come back, and I'd like to believe at some later time they're saying that 20 years after that we'll send some people there for 3 years and then we'll bring them home. So have they said anything along those lines, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW, and the Tech Man?
About a half a year ago I remember reading what the NASA's plans are. It involved roughly about 40 flights of the SLS system. So that's going to take you to roughly one, maybe three every 2 years, you know, so that's going to take you into probably 30, 34 the earliest. That's what I'm thinking. But Elon Musk, let's see how he does. I mean, he's got the plans on, you know, after Falcon 9, I mean, he's working on the engines now for the future Mars rocket called Mars... Mars, what is it? Colonial, I forget this. Boy, it's starting to go. He's got a plan. I know the name of the rocket that he's got attached to it is the Raptor. He's going to have 9 Raptor rockets. up to this Mars Colonial lander. I don't know. If he's got enough money, he might even beat NASA to Mars before 2034.
That 2034 very loose NASA prediction for man on Mars, is that the one-way mission, Paul? Or is that the mission where, after some length of time, they're going to come back home? And I think the chances of surviving this long space, you're in space for a good fraction of a year, and you've got very little protection around you, so all those solar events are going to be blasting you with radiation. Mars itself has no atmosphere, no magnetic field, per se, to give you any protection. So a person going to Mars, staying for some length of time, and coming back home, I'm reasonably sure that's not the same person you sent. That's a guy who's had a significant amount of radiation, a significant amount of bone loss, because he's spending an awful lot of time in weightlessness on the way there and on the way home. And all you've got to do is get some kind of predictable disease. Let me drop this. If on the way there, you suddenly develop a coronary artery blockage, a minor stroke, appendicitis, an abscess tooth. Man, there's a zillion things that can go wrong with you, even though you're a carefully selected human being. And the chances of accommodating all these things are not so good. So is that 2034, is that the one-way mission to Paul, or is that believed to be a X number of years on the surface and then come back home? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, they used to think 8 months there, another, you know, like a year there, you know, on the planet itself, and then maybe another 8 months back, that type of thing. That was the old plan. Now they're planning on 5 months there. They want to hook up these Hall effect Bessemer, they call them Bessemer engines. Much more higher output than what you get on the ion engines that are on Dawn, that are orbiting Cirrus now. Much more powerful. So to push a big spacecraft, they want to make it in 5 months. That's what they're looking at. Then they got to slow down, get it to orbit, and then eventually get back. If Buzz Aldrin has his way, he's going to have cyclical types of flights where, you know, you're going to have this thing that's going to keep orbiting the sun, eventually coming back to Earth. He's going to have a series of these things, you know. I mean, he's way out there. And then, so what you do is you get on the thing as it's coming by, and then you dock with it, and then it brings you to Mars. You undock, you land on Mars, and then this thing keeps going around again, picks up other crews. You know, some complicated scheme like that. That's what Buzz Aldrin wants, you know. But I think the way NASA's going to do it is send people there, and then eventually bring them back. And no, it's not a one-way trip. That's that Mars One group that character in where's he come from? Denmark or someplace. Trying to get the raise money out of these people to, you know, to create a suicide mission. Never going to happen. Back to you, Nick.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. What do you get in return? To live on Mars sounds exciting until you start getting into the specifics. We've gone there before. Living in a spacesuit is no fun. You don't want to do that very often. You don't want to do that for very many hours. Living in your habitat is going to be like living in a jail. If you can't go out there and do farming, and to go out there and do farming, you got to do it in a spacesuit. And what do you really gain by having a human being on that surface? He's nowhere near as efficient in the dollars you spend and the kilowatts you consume. If you compare what Curiosity, that Mars rover, what it can do versus what a human being can do. I'll admit you've got a little bit bit more adaptability with a human being on the surface. But if it takes you X number of trillions of dollars to get a human being there, and it takes a few thousand times less dollars to do it with an unmanned machine like Curiosity, it's very difficult to justify all that extra dollars and risk to life and limb to send a human being. So I'm awfully skeptical. It makes good science fiction. You start getting down to the specifics. And boy, there's some awfully ugly details here. That house full of stuff going into a human being and the house full of stuff coming out of a human being each year, each human being, boy, that makes a huge problem of mass flow that has to be accommodated. Okay, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, he's got this 10-room thing flying above the surface of the Earth called the International Space Station. 6 people on board. Cargo ships coming up and down on a regular basis. There's usually at least one doctor out of the group on board. And plenty of supplies, plenty of equipment. To try to duplicate this, sending people to Mars is going to be, this is a logistic nightmare. Who's ever going to put this together? But they're trying. They're trying to do it. I mean, they're building the SLS. You're going to see the first launch in 2018. No people on board. The first time you'll see people on board will probably be 2020, maybe 2021 if they're not funded.
About a minute.
We're going to see regular flights to the space station by our private companies, which is going to be great, and that's what I'm looking forward to. Eventually, maybe if this Habitat thing works out, Bigelow plans on putting his own space station or two up there with the inflatable, and then the private companies will have some place to go. SpaceX will have the Dragon. You're going to have the Starliner by Boeing, also going to be ready by next year, probably for the first manned flight. Dream Chaser, a lot of things going to be going on, but after the Mars flight, I think we've got a long way to go before we talk about that. We'll talk about how they're going to do it, but we won't be talking about them going anytime soon, Dick. Looking at the time. WS2N, we're getting late.
Yes, we are. To develop all of these launching vehicles, human-carrying vehicles, that's a good thing to do. There's a lot of ways you can apply that in near-Earth orbit and maybe going to the moon. And to say that you're doing it in preparation for Mars, it's a good-sounding goal. But I'm having a lot of trouble believing that's how the hardware is going to be applied. Excuse me. So what you guys have heard is TechNet number 1,596. I'm coming up to 1,600 here pretty soon. 73, you all. Try to be kind to each other. And fun stuff to talk about. Next week, we're going to solve all these problems. And we'll have space report number 196 next week. And John's going to have the world's best horn, 6-inch diameter horn, that launches only one wave. Let me drop. When you look at that horn that I used on the August 1972 article, the 12-foot stress parabolic dish, the feed assembly was fed down the throat. In other words, the feed horn was fed with a cable going down the center of the horn from the front. There's nothing stopping you from making that mechanism and feeding it in from the back, Paul. It's the exact same mechanism, and you can feed it from the back. For a bunch of logistics reasons, because of the way the cable got up to that dish by going down the center pipe, that's why I fed it from the front. So over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, thank you, Dick, for helping me with my project, trying to understand that, and I'm going to do some of these things maybe this week, and I might have some more information next week. Well, I'd like to thank Paul Dick, for a great net tonight. Good information. And by the way, the questions can be sent to me to be posted or broached on the TechNet at my call sign on QRZ. My email is listed, and I'll give you the call sign now. It's Juliet Baker, Juliet Baker 5, Oscar, at AOL.com. Just write those in, and we'll select them and get them on the air for you. Again, thanks for everybody checking in and having a good time. Be kind, and we'll talk to you next week, same time. All over to you, sir.
Okay, very good. And, John, good luck with that coffee can thing. Maybe the bigger coffee can. I don't know. The only thing I used the coffee can for was I attached a mag mount to it. Put it up about 15 feet in the backyard just to see what it would do. I used aluminum tape running down the PVC as a counterpoint. It did work. Dick, over to you. Have a good night. We'll catch you next week. WS22.
Now, when it comes to building a feed horn, where you want to do exact measurements to build a horn that launches a pure wave, a little more to it than first meets the eye. And there are very few books telling you that. If you take somebody's successful horn design and build a Chinese copy, you've got no problem. If you start from scratch and use good common sense, there's a 50-50 chance you can get yourself in a little bit of trouble at first. The good news is nobody dies, and it's not expensive hardware, and correcting it is not that difficult once you understand the concepts. And it's educational. And what we're proving here is that one good experiment is probably better than 1,000 theories. I've heard somebody saying that from time to time. One good experiment, properly analyzed, better than 1,000 theories. And Mother Nature did not design this universe for it to be easy for mankind to understand. There's a couple of hidden secrets there we're slowly discovering. Bye-bye, you all. Keep your eyes and be clear.
Yeah, when you do the thought experiments and then you try to model it, you see how different it is. It's not all what you think. I don't care what book you read. Something. Captain O'Reilly or whoever it is, some Irish guy who counts everything up, visits all the time. Good night, gentlemen. Talk to you soon. KC2 WGB clear.
You're talking about Murphy's Law and Elmer's Law. You know what Elmer's Law is, don't you, John?
I think he said Murphy was an optimist.
You got it. Elmer said that Murphy was an optimist. The real world's a little worse. Bye-bye, you all.
Good stuff. KC2WGB clear.
Dick, N2XVN, quick question. I sent you email and I was asking for your response. There is an article, scientific article, that is standing about RF and health. And if you don't mind to take a look at it, the email was at March
29th. Roy gave you a response a couple of days ago. Is Roy responding to the exact same article you're referring to, Westgrad?
Oh, it is not. The email title is "Your response is very much needed, RFI versus health." I've got email from scientists from Europe, and he experienced some problems, and he gave me the PDF, and the PDF there is electromagnetic radiation and epilepsy. Could take a look at it.
So is the article written on the premise that RF radiation, particularly from something like a cell phone or operating two-way radios, that it does create epilepsy? Is that the main premise of the article?
No, actually, this article is more broad than only the epilepsy in it. It is written by Andy Davidson.